For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hi, hello, how's it going? Yeah, I know, but welcome to Good One, a podcast about jokes. I'm your host, Vulture Senior Editor, Jesse David Fox. Each episode, including this one, a comedian comes on to play a clip of one of their jokes and then discuss how they wrote it and how it fits into what they're trying to do with their comedy. Of the many things that have since been canceled or postponed due to COVID-19, the biggest for comedy was the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It's the world's largest arts festival, usually taking place over 25 days in Edinburgh, Scotland, with like 60,000 performers spread out over 3,000 venues. Though it's not exclusively comedy, it is at the center of British comedy and has helped define how many comedians in the UK and the world in general approach writing. We talked a little about this in the Ronnie Chang episode. So instead of here in the States, where a comedian starts with zero and builds an hour through a series of 10-minute sets, UK comedians start with a full hour that they refine night after night at Edinburgh and then spend the year touring. This week's guest, Daniel Sloss, is actually from Edinburgh and made a name for himself at the Fringe Festival, which he started performing at as a teen and has since done 10 full shows. The joke we discussed this episode, which was a bit of a breakthrough for Daniel, had a long evolution. An idea started as a tweet in 2012, got told in multiple Edinburgh shows, growing as he continued to have new experiences with it, including an eye-opening trip to America in 2014, finally ending as part of his 2015 show, Dark. But that's not it, because the film version of Dark wouldn't come out on Netflix until 2018. That means Daniel worked on and performed multiple Fringe shows in between. Dark is a special of dark comedy that defends, if not celebrates, the value of dark comedy, rooted in Daniel's own personal history of losing his sister at a young age. In terms of film specials, Jigsaw, also on Netflix, is about dating and marriage and ends with a plea for people to end bad relationships. As we discussed in the episode, a truly unbelievable amount of people took his advice. His most recent special, X, which came out in 2019 on HBO, uses Daniel's unique ability to discuss difficult subjects to talk very directly about toxic masculinity and sexual assault. It is really powerful. But all comedians start somewhere, and that comedian started with this joke. Again, this is from Daniel's 2018 taping of his 2015 Edinburgh show Dark, from a joke that started in 2012. We talked to Daniel in February of this year. So, here is Daniel Sloss.
A couple of years ago, I went to Indiana, right? It's a beautiful, beautiful state. The people there are very kind, except for one of them. One of my favorite jokes I have, now me personally, I've always been an atheist, and that's just because both my parents are educated. And I grew up in a very religious family. I have an uncle that's a minister. He's 5'2". We call him a mini-ster. Religion was something that you were allowed to poke fun of when I grew up. And then I came to America and I'm like, oh, it'll be the same here. I phoned up an American agent and I'm like, I can tell the atheist joke in Indiana, right? And she said, under no circumstance, tell that joke in Indiana. So I went to Indiana and I told the joke, right? Because wet paint... That is wet paint. That's why they put the sign there, just to let you all know. No, I'm used to having jokes I do not go down as well as I wanted them. What I was not used to was the reaction I got as I got to my first punchline, off many, in Indiana. Got to the first punchline, 40 out of 100 people immediately left the room. Right? Yeah, and not in the British way of like, oh, this isn't for us, we should quietly and respectfully leave. They left in the American way of like, fuck you, and gone. And it's important to note that the 60 people that remained weren't all fans, okay? Some of them were just very stubborn. Like, they hated me, but not as much as they loved sitting down. That was a real moral dilemma for them. They're like, this is awful, but I do love this. This is excellent. Now, I'm not an intelligent person by any stretch, so I was like, oh, maybe I'll win them over with the harsher punchlines. Oh, that'll get them. No, not at all. There was a man in the front row who was so upset by the joke, his only way of letting me know how angry he was to lift up his shirt, show me his gun, and say, you're lucky I don't shoot you. Now, where I come from, we don't call that luck. We call that society. I run my mouth off for every day. Never been shot in the fucking head. Right? But I've never seen a gun in my life. In my life at this point. And it's just there. It's pointing at his dick. I've always found that weird. Oh, fucking gay. Is that why you're all circumcised? Just, oh, no, what have I done? And I'm terrified. I've never seen a gun before. And this is what I love about your country, right? Because I think there is one stereotype that is true for most of you. And it's the friendliness, right? There is that just sense of friendliness. There was another American man there. He was realistically as upset by this joke as this man. But he stood up for me. And he did so in the most American way possible. Proper big American, big beard. Looked like he ate pancakes and shat freedom. Right? And he stood up and went, hey, you. Hey, little boy. Bit condescending. Little boy. Right? Hey. I may not agree with what you're saying. Loved you in Home Alone. Thought that was spot on. I may not agree with what you're saying, but this is America. This is the land of the free speech. So you keep telling your joke and you just ignore him. Because if he shoots you, I'll shoot him. Not before? Like, if you're taking requests, before really works for me. Now, I will tell you the joke. Obviously, I've not learned any lessons. It was a very simple premise for a joke, as are all my jokes. It was basically, you know, as a parent, now I'm not a parent, but I do like speaking on behalf of people because I'm white, middle class, and male. And that's what my people do. I imagine Christmas morning as a parent is very difficult, especially if you have young children. It's Christmas morning, it's 7 a.m. They burst out of their rooms, they run downstairs, they're so happy, they're so filled with joy. It's Christmas Day! It's the most magical day of the year. To them, magic literally happened overnight. They wished for shit, shit's there. What the fuck? That's insane. I'm 7 years old, but I'm pretty sure that tree shits presents. But you as a parent, you know, the time, the money, the organization, the stress that's gone into making this moment so special. But when you see that smile on their stupid fucking face, makes it all worth it. Then they look up at you with those big blue eyes that you hope resemble yours. And who do they thank? Santa. Oh, thank you, Santa, for these presents. Mummy and Daddy, isn't Santa amazing? And as a parent not willing to shatter your child's imagination, you must have to stand there being like, fuck. You know that disappointment that parents feel in that moment? That is exactly how doctors feel whenever you thank God. Mr. Darcy, we are delighted to announce that your cancer has gone into remission. Oh my God, this is wonderful news. I know it's been a long, hard journey, but we got there in the end and we all couldn't be happier for you. Oh, thank the Lord. What? No, sorry, it's just funny. I just couldn't see his name anywhere on this fucking chart. I can see my name right at the top there. Dr. Michael sat with you through 2.5 weeks of chemotherapy. You're welcome, by the way. Dr. Connors, her name's there. She spent 6 hours cutting a tumor out your fucking lung. I've got the names of all the nurses and all the radiologists here. All their names are on this. I can't seem to find the Lord's name anywhere on it. I tell you what, maybe in my haste to give you the good news, maybe I skim past it. I'll have another look. Oh, so weird. No, God. He's, but the Lord sent you. I don't think he did. certainly didn't chip in for that medical degree. In fact, if I remember correctly, you came to me, I diagnosed you, and then I specified the treatment. In fact, if I cast my memory even further back, he's the one that gave you cancer. Why? Maybe because you're an ungrateful cunt.
I'm here with Daniel Sluss. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm so excited. So I want to set the table a little bit. So your first Edinburgh Fringe was in 2008.
Yeah, first solo show.
Solo show in 2008. You talk pretty harshly about how you were as a comedian for your first handful of years.
Ah, shite.
Yeah. How long were you bad? And when you say bad, what does that mean to you?
I wasn't bad. I was still better than most other people. No, I was just, there was no, it was what I describe as porridge comedy.
Yeah.
There was no substance to it. It was just, I was a young person doing a very good impression of a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any fucking life experience, said the 29-year-old. So I just thought, yeah, when I look back at the material now, the jokes were good. They worked as jokes, but that's all they were. There was no depth to them. There was no creativity. Nothing was challenging. Nothing was different. It was bland and it was flavorless, but still filling. The audiences liked it.
You think of a joke or that typified that certain flaws, that sort of thoughtlessness?
Yeah, my one of my first jokes was about my mum's tits. My mum has large breasts, and the reason I know that is because I have eyes and I got bullied for it in high school. So I had a joke which was talking about my friend always make fun of me because I get bullied at school because my mum's got big breasts, and I don't know what's worse about it, getting bullied for my mum having big breasts or the look of pride and satisfaction on my father's face when I tell him I'm being bullied about it.
You know, you, as you said, you were successful early on. People were laughing. What made you realize you wanted to be better?
Because I fucking hated my audience. I didn't like them. I got lucky enough to, one of my early breaks was on a show called Paul O'Grady, which is essentially pre-Watershed in the UK. And they stuck me on and they censored my material in the sense that I wasn't allowed to swear. None of the rude bits were allowed in. And then I went on stage and it was just, people were getting just upset by swearing, which to me is so fucking pathetic. It's so fucking pathetic to be offended by swearing. It's like being allergic to water.
Yeah.
It's the blandest fucking thing, and you're upset by that. How do you expect me to respect any part of you as a person if a simple fucking word, not even said with malice, upsets you?
Mm.
Fuck off. Yeah. I have no interest in you as a human being. You are utterly beneath me.
Yeah.
And people were getting upset. I don't like how much you swear. I don't like when people going, comedy's getting very blue. You go, oh, fuck off. I hated them so fucking.
The idea of 2012 that comedy's getting so blue.
Aye, it was just, and the joke that we're going to be discussing, I remember it was first time I started doing it, was the first joke where there was depth to it. It was smart. And I was like, it was the first joke other comedians were jealous of.
Yeah.
And nothing makes you feel more like a fucking comedian when other comedians go, well, fuck you for that joke. Fuck you. That's, you know, I wish I'd written that routine. But I remember being on stage at the Edinburgh Festival doing it on my like sixth or seventh show. And people would get up and walk out, like 20 or 30 people a show, because they'd seen me on telly being a young, cheeky chappy, heavily censored, not swearing, not doing anything too taboo. And then I'm on stage telling, you know, cancer jokes and there's no God, and people would leave. And it was really hard. It was a hard decision to make because I was like, your neediness to want to appease to everyone. I had to really put my foot down on myself and go, no, like, you don't want those people as fans. The ones that are staying, cultivate them, keep them, find your audience. Don't try and be so broadly fucking appealing.
So I want to sort of set a sort of timeline of this. So in 2012, you tweeted, you know how parents get annoyed by Santa getting all the credit for Xmas presents? That's how doctors feel when you thank God. So that's 2012.
I tested it on Twitter.
Yeah.
I remember writing it down on my phone. Maybe I was tweeting. Maybe I was.
Did. Yeah.
I remember exactly where I was as well. I was in the car on the way back up from Kendal in the UK. And I think my dad was driving, and I said the joke to him. And he was like, that's very funny. I always try out my material on my parents. And I think, I don't even think it banged on Twitter. Like, I don't think.
Looking at the numbers, it did not seem like it
did. Did it not? No. But that's, I knew I was right. I knew it was funny.
I want to back up and sort of provide some context about your history of religion. You talk about how you were raised by atheist parents, but you do have religious relatives, including an uncle who is a minister.
Mm-hmm.
When did you realize you're an atheist as a kid, like in so much as other people were not?
It was when my sister died. Like, I think before then I was religious in the sense that, you know, I had no choice. The reason most people are religious is because their parents are religious. Now, my dad has always been atheist because he's a man of intellect. Whereas my mom was raised by religious parents, so mm-hmm. she always was. And fucking, man, the Christians offered so many good things. It was like a camp you could go to where you could ride horses and shoot guns. And I'm like, yeah, I'll be Christian. This is great. Let's do this. I didn't believe, you know, I was just young. I remember the stories and there's a God and you pray to him and grandparents would take me to church every now and again. And then my sister with cerebral palsy died and I went, oh, there's no God. Like, there's just not one. Like,
yeah.
Of course there's not. And I remember that's when my mum lost her faith as well. Like, because not even in a bad way, but my dad sat her down and was like, you don't get to believe in God anymore. You just don't. You can't. Yeah. I can't respect you if you do. Like your innocent daughter died. You do not get to believe in God anymore. And my mum was like, yeah, no, it makes sense. Like, there just isn't. And and then from then on, religion, it was like a fucking wake up. It just infuriated me.
Yeah.
I no longer respected it. I didn't want it to be at the forefront. Like, people would be like, it's personal. I'm like, it's fucking rarely personal. Mm-hmm. It's rarely fucking personal.
I listened to a lot of interviews with you. And what's interesting is sort of around the themes that you're going to be talking, you talk about that theme to everyone that will allow you to talk about it. Yeah. So like in 2015, 2014, 2016, you're just talking about religion in every single conversation I can find. Is that sort of how you're starting, which is, I want to write material around religion. I'm going to keep on talking about it and start with the ideas you're looking to express before just the sparks?
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's conversation. I like, you know, spirited debate. I like dialogue and stuff. And it's a good way of working out what your opinions are. Like when I started being a better comic was when I wasn't writing jokes. I wasn't sitting down with a blank bit of paper and like, I'm going to write a joke about this. I was talking about things I was passionate about. And the more passionate I was about something, and the funnier I was about it. Yeah, it was in my head more than I... There were some things you say things and you just go, oh, I didn't know I thought that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know that was my opinion. And when you say things over and over and over again, they naturally get more tight and more succinct and, you know... Yeah, bringing it up all the time and discussing it openly really helps me flesh out ideas.
So you tweet this, which, you know, you tweet things, one tweets things and you're like, now I'm done with it. I've had this stupid idea. What made it stick with you? What made you like, oh, I need to work on this to make this something I'd actually talk about on stage?
Because I knew it would fucking piss people off. And I knew that line would piss off people I hated. Like the very, very zealot religious people, I knew it would fucking wind them up. And I wanted to do that because they, you know, they wound me up all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, tit for tat, this is, you're going to go around shouting your stupid shit, I'll go around shouting my stupid shit.
In comedy, you know, writing is a broad term. At this point, what does writing look like?
So that time I would always, my process was I would type it out on a computer. And then, like, I would print it out and, like, sort of rehearse it just to get all the lines in my head and make sure that my delivery... Man, I'm talking, like, holding my mother's comb, looking in the mirror, fucking typical rehearsing. That's what I used to do. And because my mum made me have a work ethic, because I still lived at home with my mum. She was like, if you're going to fucking do this for a job, you're going to do this as a fucking job. She works from home. She's like, you're coming downstairs and you're doing it 9 at 5 in front of the computer. So we sat in there writing my jokes, and the only time I was allowed up was to go and, you know, practice in front of the mirror. And, so it would get in my head, and then I'd record the set. I would do a set. I would do it on stage that night, and then I would sit down with the bit of paper, and whenever there was a laugh, I'd do a tick on the bit of paper, and be like, laugh there, laugh there. And if like if I fluffed a line or something, it was like a squiggle that had been like, you need to perform this better. This needs to be tighter. And what that let me know is you can see where the punchlines are. You can go, right, they laugh there, they laugh there, but then they don't laugh again to there. So either there needs to be three jokes in that point, or this needs to be tightened down as much as possible, because I want it to be fucking gag heavy. Like, my favorite comedy that I ever laughed at was the stuff where you're struggling to breathe. You know that fucking laugh that you get, like when you're young and you're staying over at your friend's house and it's past midnight and you're not allowed to be up, and you can't breathe, tears are streaming down your face, like that. That's what I always want to do. So I want to make it punchy as fuck. But when I started doing this joke, there was different levels of it, which was, there were silences where I was just going, no, leave those in.
Yeah, yeah.
Like those, that having them be shocked by these bits is good. I've evoked a reaction, therefore I'm in control of a reaction. Now I'm in charge of your emotions. It was a very stupid thing of you to do to let me know I could upset you. And now I'm in command.
So the joke has, I'd say, sort of two sections. When you play the joke as is, it just sort of starts being like, you know, Christmas morning, and you're just talking about that. What do you like about that style, where it's sort of a longer build up to what it's actually about?
Because up until the punchline, it's not a horrible joke.
Yeah.
It's a lovely story. You're evoking childhood memories or joyous memories of parenthood. There are religious people in the audience going, what a lovely joke about Christmas. Ah, the Christ-like holiday, the best time of the fucking year where we all pray to, you know. That. Yeah,
I didn't even think about how Christmas is a religious holiday.
Yeah.
That's part of the joke.
But it evokes this is going to be a nice joke, I'm listening, and then I punch you in the fucking face.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's something about the structure of the first half, which, you know, it can somewhat be a joke, which is like, oh, it's, you know, these kids are ungrateful. It's actually very similar. I don't know if you know the Bill Cosby thank you mom joke. He has a joke about a father raising his son to play football, and he trains him every day, and he wakes up every weekend to show him how to throw a football. Right. And then he like wins the big game, and the reporter is like, do you have anything to say? He goes, thanks, mom.
Oh, great. Okay.
So yeah, this joke has a similar like that. And you're like, I guess that's, and then it's a complete sideways.
Yeah, but it happens all the time. It happens in sports. You have UFC fighters or boxers, right, who just won a fight, and their entire coaching staff are behind them, who like missed their kids' pageants to help this person win a fight. And they're like, I'd like to thank God. And you're like, no, you don't. No, you ungrateful prick. Like, that's not who did it.
And then so then what's interesting is sort of there's the metaphor, which is a scene, and then the act out, which is also a scene. Mm. It would be too much to say like, oh, this is more of a Edinburgh or UK style, but it is more stagey than I think an American comedian wouldn't. It just so clearly shows that you wrote something and prepared it.
And it's something that, like, the first time I came to America, it blew my mind that comedians just went on stage with no fucking material. I'm like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And it's because over here there's no, not to sound like a dick, but none of you ever feared your audience. Mm-hmm. And it shows. Like, American audiences are so, from the second you walk out on stage, it's let's give this guy a chance. Like, why would he be on stage if he wasn't good at what he do? Whereas a comedian, you're like, no, there's so many shit comedians out there. Like, and in the UK, if you do not make that audience laugh, like we did gong shows. I don't know if that's a concept here.
Not for a very long time.
Right. Well, gong shows are pretty much the only way you could get spots at like the Comedy Store in Manchester. Was you go on stage, you've got 5 minutes. If you last the 5 minutes, you can come back maybe and do another five at a real night. But there's three people in the audience with their cards. And if those three cards go out, you get gonged off halfway through your fucking set. It's a horrible, terrifying thing. You've got to make the audience laugh from the fucking get-go, especially when I was young. Like, I walked on set. Mm-hmm. I look young now. I look like sperm when I was 17. Like, I was so youthful that they didn't trust that I was going to be funny. And I always had to be the best in the bill. I always had to just punchline, 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 punchline. And, you know, to know that the jokes are funny, I had to put the work in. And then I come over here and comedians who I love, like Bill Burr, he said a bit of advice on a podcast once, and it's a bit of advice that I can't take on board, and it kills me because I love him so much. But it was, he was like, you wouldn't rehearse a conversation in front of your friends in the pub. And I go, well, no, Bill, but we can't all, you know, be as good as you. Yeah. Like, it's not that natural. But also, I do kind of practice it in conversations. Yeah. It comes up.
Something about an American style had evolved where, especially over time, by the time you're coming up, by the 21st century, where you wanted to seem like it was not rehearsed, even if it was rehearsed.
But that's the con. That's yeah. the con is convincing. For me, it's always been, you have to convince the audience that this is the first time you've told the fucking joke. But what I think happened is you've got all these amazing comedians who do that mm-hmm. so well. And then you have this generation of damn comedians go, oh, you just go on and talk. And you go, no, you fucking idiot. No, you've missed the entire point. The point is these... Dave Chappelle's a bad example. He probably is just saying those things. But that's after, you know, years and years of what he's doing. But all the rest of, you know, these specials where you watch them being effortless, the reason they're effortless, I believe, is because it is so fucking tight. It is so ingrained. They know every single thing. And that's how they can make it look unrehearsed.
You've talked about how Edinburgh is like doing 2 years on the road in 30 days. You're doing it every night. So... you're doing this and people are walking out. Over those course of 30 days, how's the joke evolving and how are you evolving to sort of like get through that? By the end of 30 days, what are you now as this comedian?
Because now there's, I'm becoming better because I'm learning slowly that it doesn't matter. It's not about appeasing everyone. And also, like in the lamest possible way, it felt fucking naughty. Like the people that stay in the audience with you, They're also thrilled that people walked out. That makes it funnier for them.
Yeah.
You know, people getting annoyed by this. And the reason they're getting annoyed isn't because the joke's offensive or anything like that. The reason they're getting upset is because your faith isn't as strong as you thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I believe that the world is round. You can make fun of me for believing that the world is round all you want. I'll never be upset by you insulting me because the world's round, because that's how strong my faith is. I insult your fucking religion. Why do you get pissed off? Because I made you doubt it. I rocked your belief. And that's a level of power. So I got more confident in it. It was the, you know, I like having a swagger on stage. I like the, you know, the fucking Jeselnik chest pumped out. I'm the greatest person in this room. Because that's so fun to, and it allows you to get away with so much more. So I think I was learning that. I was really making the transition from being the, hey, like, here's some awkward things and I get embarrassed by this shit to, oh, now I'm more firm in my opinions and I don't care sincerely if you're upset, because if you are upset, good.
Yeah. So you jump to 2014. You're now going to do shows in America. You ask your American agent if you should do this joke. What happens?
I
go step by step.
I go to, I remember my very first gig in America was Comedy Works in Denver, which still to me is one of the best comedy clubs in the world. And I was, man, nervous as fucking shit. I know how Christian this country is. Everyone in the world knows how Christian this country is. It's like you sing about it all of the time. Like it's on your money, you psychopaths. You're so violently religious here. And I'm like, but it's just a joke.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a joke. And I go to Denver and I'm a bit worried about doing it there. And it gets a similar reaction to the Edinburgh reaction, which is some people get annoyed, but the rest of them take it for what, even the religious people in the room who, where their faith is strong, laugh at the joke because they're like, it's just a funny joke.
Yeah.
And then in Indianapolis, like I was like, I'd heard it was a red state and I'd heard it was much more, you know, center. And my agent, Joanne, was just like, she was like, no, she's like, genuinely don't fucking do it there. And I didn't do it for two of the shows in Indiana. I just didn't do it. I sort of dipped my toe in the water by doing my gay penguin routine there. And I'm like, and the gay penguin routine went down well.
Yeah.
Right? It went down well every single night. And the host at the time is a comic and friend of mine called Brad Scott. And I told him the joke backstage. I was like, I'm never going to do it here. And he was like, oh, you know, you should, you know, I think you should tell it. And I go on stage. And my logic was that they're laughing at a gay penguin joke, right? So you can't be you can't laugh at a joke about gay penguins and be religious. Like, sure. you've made your bed. You don't like the gay. So if you're laughing at a joke which is very pro-gay, you can't also be pro-God. Those aren't my words. Those are literally your words.
At least in the time in which this joke is
being performed. Yes, yes. And especially in this part of the country as well. This is the we're not gonna sell you a gay cake clip part, right? Yeah, so I'm like, clearly I've found the only atheists in Indiana. And I go on stage and I do the joke, and two or three people laugh. My memories of it's quite fucking skewed because it was scary. But a man in the front, you know, lifted up his shirt, showed me his gun and said, "You're lucky I don't shoot you." And now, in hindsight, I understand he was never going to shoot me. Yeah. It was just gun banter.
Yeah.
But I come from a country that doesn't have guns. We don't have gun banter. It's a new level of humor that I'm not used to. I'm just a 22 or 3-year-old looking at a man with a gun, and he's just threatened to shoot me. And they're so annoyed. They are visibly upset to the point where people storm out. I finish my set as quickly as I can. I go off and I'm fucking hiding in the back room. People are trying to get back in because they're so fucking angry. They're trying to get refunds. They're yelling at the staff, which makes me feel like a piece of shit. I don't give a fuck if I get yelled at. But I don't want the staff having to take the brunt of my actions. They're suffering the consequences for what I did. That makes me feel like shit. But yeah, they get annoyed to the point where I'm like, well, I'll obviously never tell this fucking joke in America again. Like, it's just not... Because being shot's not an option in the UK. It was a new level of... I'm fearless on stage in Scotland because that's not a threat. Like, you can stab me, but it'll take you a while and I'll see you coming and hopefully someone... Or, you know, you'll throw a pint glass or, you know, there's still ways of violence, but it's a fucking gun.
So you also tell... a story of a man complaining about, I mean, I don't know if maybe that was just for the joke where what ends up being the next part of the joke of, oh, I like comedy, but I don't like jokes. I like jokes about.
Jesus. Oh, that guy was an amalgamation of all of the people there, all of the complaints, but I just personified him into one thing to make me look like the hero.
So what did you learn about yourself in that moment? What did you learn about comedy in that moment? What did you learn about America?
What I learned about myself is I'm not as brave as I thought I was. maybe stupider than I thought it was. I learned that I should fucking listen to my agent sometimes. Mm-hmm. I learned at what point, you know, how far I'm willing to antagonize. Yeah. And I still will, but... I didn't dip a toe across the line. I fucking sprinted across it and tore down, you know, all the do not cross signs and shat in someone's yard and did whatever. So I learned but I did also enjoy it. I learned that you can get fucking material out of it.
Yeah.
Like I survived it. So in all honesty, I learned nothing.
That thrill in a way. Were you like, that's something that I need to chase? Or not even chase, but like, there's something magical about that.
There is. I don't know who you are. I don't know your fucking name. I don't know who you are. Yeah, I have this, I can evoke this much of a reaction from you. That's insane. Why would you give me this level of power? And it is a power. Like, you know, it blows my mind when people online go, this joke really upset me. And I'm like, fucking thanks for the spinach. I'm going to turn more into Popeye here. Like, you're letting me know the control and the rent space I have in your head. And it's, I like that in a really cunty way.
You grew up in the UK, but you watched American stand-ups. And you were seeing final products for the most part. And then now you're an American stand-up, ostensibly. How did it sort of fill out your picture of like what it means to be a stand-up in America?
What I will say about, and this might piss a lot of people off, I think the top 10% of American comedians are the best in the world, bar none. You've got a few outliers from the rest of the world, like Scotland's, we've obviously got like Billy Connolly, but the top 10% of American comics are the best in the world. Then you've got the next 15% who are really good, like really good. But what I would say is as good as like the best in the UK. And then the bottom 75 are the worst fucking stand-ups in the fucking world, bar none. Shockingly appalling. Like, because you don't fear your audience. And it shook, man. I remember the many gigs when I started coming over to LA and just being so fucking nervous. Just like, I'm in America, man. I'm in America, the capital of fucking comedy. And just people going on stage and just talking about their fucking day. Just telling people what they had for fucking lunch, their shitty opinions that they wrote down in a fucking car. No respect for the audience, no respect for themselves, no respect for the fucking art. And I'm like, I'm going to fucking crush it. Like, and I did, because I went on with punchlines. I remember like the first minute just going gag, 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 because I was so, I'm like, fucking, I can do this. Yeah. Yeah, that's going to piss people off. I mean it, though. Like, sincerely, go to the rest of the world and see what their open mic scene like. The young scene in Australia is amazing. The amount of brilliant comics that are coming out there is amazing. Even in fucking places like Russia, their scene is fucking growing. There's Eastern Europe. There's all these new scenes are coming up. New York's a bad example because everyone here wants to be a comedian, whereas every comedian in LA wants to be an actor or a TV presenter, which I don't resent, by the way. I resent it in a bit of, you know, you're taking stage time off of people who genuinely want to do this for a living, but the game is the game. I'm not going to begrudge anyone for taking opportunities and taking advantage of it. But it fucking shows that there's just not a love of the craft and a love of the craft that the rest of the world has because we grew up watching that 10%. We grew up watching that amazing 10% and then via podcast finding out about the 15% and being like, fucking hell, have you heard of Pete Holmes? Have you heard of Patrice O'Neill? Have you heard of Tech Notaro? Have you heard of all these? And you're getting so excited. You're like, I've discovered it. And obviously these comedians are big here, but we didn't know about them until podcast. That's exciting. So that's what you think American comedy is. You're like, they're all, oh my God, they're so good. And then you've got this bottom fucking 75 who've never watched stand-up in their fucking life, or they did watch stand-up and they misunderstood it. They misunderstood it. They went, I've watched this comedian walk on stage and casually talk about things. All I'm going to do is go on stage and casually talk about things. And it fucking shows.
What you're responding to is there is a level that you're allowed to exist at in comedy that is not as demanding and still be a comedian. Partly because of there's large swaths of audiences who do not expect anything more. Because it's a system of clubs instead of like you're doing shows and people are not showing up. They're showing up just to see comedy instead of they're showing up to see a person.
Yeah.
So you have two options, right? When you have an audience that's not yours. You can either be like, I'm going to make it undeniable that I am who I am and they're going to become a fan of mine.
Yeah.
Or it's like, I need to get through this. I'm going to just do what I need to get through, which is not seeing comedy as a craft or an art. It's seeing it as a job.
Yes,
And that is a little bit different. Because you can have it as a job in that way, it mixed with you can also sort of like do comedy as sort of a hobby while being a famous person.
I will agree with that. But I also, for me, man, I love this fucking job so much. So if you don't, I get annoyed by it in the UK, you get comedians that are complaining, like, I don't like this job. And I go, quit. Fuck off. We don't need any more of you, right? If you do not love this, fuck off and stop wasting your time. Do you know how lucky it is to be in a job that you genuinely fucking love? How rare that is in the world? And especially a job where you work, 2 hours a night?
Yeah.
You get to travel, people fucking adore you. You don't love that? You don't take that seriously? Get out.
Yeah.
Get out. Like, you don't respect that audience, no matter who they are, the ones that came out, they booked a babysitter, they booked time off, they waited a week to fucking see you, or even not just you, but they came out to a fucking comedy club, and you have the fucking audacity to not try. Fuck off.
Yeah.
I don't respect it.
So,
and I will say, because I know it's going to piss off a lot of American comics, I did pull those percentages out of my ass, but it's...
He didn't count. He doesn't have a name of who's the first example of the worst comedian in America. So as a result, you have sort of this core joke and then the story of a man pulling a gun out of you and the gun out at you, and also sort of the follow-up story of just sort of the audience complaining reaction that you cultivate. And so this whole routine, I believe you're doing the 2014 Edinburgh show, really. And then, of course, this becomes a part of 2015 show, Dark. I think this joke is a good way to sort of talk about Edinburgh shows as a whole, which, you know, they can range from hours of jokes that are more similar to like a very traditional American stand-up to a whole piece like a Nanette, which I think is probably the most popular in America of those shows. So how did you build a show? How does a joke like this fit into both? And then I guess sort of as you think about how this joke fits into Dark opposed to Really, what does it say about how you sort of constructed Dark?
Well, Dark was we named it just because everyone was calling me Dark and I was just so sick of being called Dark. And I was like, right, fucking just own it and talk about that. And because I don't see myself as Dark, obviously. But that was one of my darker jokes, ones that I knew, you know, would evoke that reaction. But it became part of the narrative in a way, like, cause that was the show, which I didn't mean for the show Dark to be dark. You know, I came to America and I wrote a joke about, did a show where I got to talk about something I'd never spoken about on stage, and that's when I started speaking about my sister, Josie, and that was the first...
This was at Risk.
Yes, it was at Risk in LA. And it went really well. And it was the only reason I then suddenly realised I'd listened to Tig Notaro's Live as well, and just that thing of where you just go, oh, fuck. Like, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know that was an option. That's amazing. She really inspired that sort of honesty, the rawness of truth and uncomfortableness, and that silences in comedy aren't necessarily bad when you're in control of them.
I want to have a sense of, especially Dark, which sort of fits as a, you know, it's not a narrative necessarily, but it then also happens in Jigsaw and X, where you sort of like, at the beginning of the show, you'll joke about a subject area in a straight joking way. Mm. And then the end of the show, as you described, you do sort of a 20-minute TED Talk, which often looks at one of the subjects we've already talked about, but in a much more serious way. And I think in Dark, which is sort of the first where I think you figured it out, which is sort of you do quote-unquote dark comedy, and then you're like, this dark comedian you saw, this is the why of it.
Yes.
Is that how did you land on that opposed to a integrated show or, you know, like that style of I'm going to do jokes that are sort of around and then, you know, two sort of separate with a sort of harsh turn?
Dumb luck. Sheer dumb luck and coincidence. It was never my intention with any of those shows. Like the show Dark was just going to be a compilation of jokes, which is what my shows essentially always are. And then the narrative came in and it just fit. Like the story about Josie just complimented the stuff. And then I realized that there was a through line. And through performing it every day at the Fringe as well, your brain suddenly goes, oh, connection, connection, connection. So it naturally tightens the more you perform it. Same thing happened with Jigsaw. And the end of Jigsaw didn't work for so long. Like it was... I couldn't get that joke working because I was just so angry at people in shitty relationships. I was just yelling at the audience, just going, the reason you're all in these fucking relationships is because you're all lonely and you're all pathetic being single. And the audience going, what are you fucking, what is this? This is horrible. And my best friend, Jean, she hadn't even seen the show. And she goes, I know exactly what you've done without even seeing the show. That's what you always do, which is you've made it about them and you need to make it about you. How did you arrive at these conclusions? And the second I turned it back on myself and went, oh, fuck, okay, it tied in. And then it started working. And then when it started working, I got more passion in it. And once again, then it became, I went, these are the 40 minutes of jokes. And then there's this end joke, which is just has a little bit of a serious bit. And then it's all the ingredients, and then it becomes the cake. It's genuinely never intentional. Even with X especially, was it once again, X was just going to be just another hour of jokes where I occasionally would talk about toxic masculinity and the love of my goddaughter. And then my friend sexually assaulted my other friend, and I was like, I can't not talk mm-hmm. about this. Like, it is on my mind, especially like I do like being honest on stage. I do think it's important. And I remember writing the show and doing previews of it in small parts of Scotland, and I'm just going, I'm not saying what I want to say. I'm saying some of what I want to say. I'm talking about topics I want to talk about, but I'm not saying what I want to actually say. And then I started writing it with my my other friend, the end bit, just to get obviously the tone right. And then it naturally, coincidentally, tied in with the toxic masculinity stuff. And
so there's parts of you that you're doing what you're doing, and because of comedian, you connections happen that are out of control. Your brain is figuring it out, and then like, oh, look at this! I've
never sat down and went, I'm going to write a show.
Yeah,
I write jokes, and then I put those jokes together into a show, and then I've been really fucking, you know, lucky that they have then formed together to coalesce into this narrative. But I've never been like, all right, okay, act one, act two, act three.
Yeah. So this period is a really interesting thing as an American consumer of comedy, which is, so you do Dark in 2015, you toured a little bit, but 2016, you're now doing Jigsaw. You tour that a bit and you filmed that.
Mm-hmm.
2017, you're now working on another show that I guess became Now.
So yeah, Now, which is going to be renamed Socio, which was filmed in Austin, Texas. We filmed that last year.
So, but by the time you're done touring Dark, from what I've heard you explain, like, you knew you were going to do it for Netflix, but the timing of that was sort of held back.
Oh, yeah.
So which means there's a sort of this period where you're working on other shows and Dark sort of exists.
Yeah. And it does my fucking head, and I still have it now. I fucking hate having a back catalog. I hate it so much. It's so hard to look forward when you've got things behind you. The fact that Socio isn't out is driving me insane.
It does mess with the sort of idea that a comedian goes, like, you're seeing a comedian what they were at that time, but yours are sort of jumping all over the place.
Because me, like, when I finally filmed Dark, like, Dark was dead. Dark was 2 years fucking old and finished and wasn't even filmed. And then while I was on the Socio tour, the Now tour, I get the Netflix deals. It was in the back. So I had to go back and revisit the show, which I didn't mind, by the way, like, because, you know, the show Dark on Netflix was not, it's nowhere, it's way better than what the show Dark was. It was fun to go back to those jokes and perform them better, like, as a better comic. That was nice.
There's a video that I saw of you doing this joke in 2016, and the only real difference, it's, you know, it's pretty much, especially the second half is almost exactly the same, but the lead up, is the Christmas part is much longer by 2018.
Yeah.
Do you think that reflects just one, doing it more, and also how you grew as a comedian and sort of the comfort in not having to rush to the joke?
100%, yes. I was getting that. I was less terrified of my audiences.
Yeah.
Like, it was no longer about, you know, I knew I was going to make them laugh. I knew where the punchlines were, so I could be, you know, I could meander up to them slower and enjoy the performance more. Because watching, you know, so many of the great American comedians, the act outs, I've always loved. For me, it's the, you know, Bill Burr's helicopter bit
That helicopter, it's interesting you bring that up, because that special came out between when you finished working on Dark and when you filmed Dark. It's just like, literally the next question was going to be about the special that came out between that time. So that's from Walk Your Way Out, where he ends with this big helicopter bit. Talk about watching Bill Burr, because you, unlike certain comedians, don't watch other comics, but you've talked about how you study.
Yeah, it blows my mind that the comedians don't watch other comics. Like, do you reckon footballers who aren't in the World Cup final don't fucking watch the World Cup final? They're not watching the chat. What are you doing? Do you love this game or not? Like, I've watched comedy since I was 5 years old. I love it, man. And I understand the fear that people have of, I don't want to be fucking influenced. I'm like, I do. I absolutely do. I want to see what the best are doing and be fucking inspired. Like, seeing comedians at the top of their game going, I didn't, Tig Notaro doing that lift out of going, I didn't know I could do that. Bill Burr, that helicopter bit, I didn't know mic technique could be so impressive. I didn't know you could play around. Like the act house, watching comedians do all these so many impressive bits, I'm like, fucking, why don't I? What? The reason she's the best at this is because she does that. And I don't think that's stealing or borrowing. It's being inspired.
Yeah.
Like it's just going, fucking, okay, we can do more. It's like a chef not eating at other restaurants.
Yeah.
But sometimes when I write a funny joke, I'm like, fuck, have I heard this on a special somewhere?
Yeah.
Like, is this my own genuine fucking thought? And that's why it's good to be friends with so many comedians who also love comedy, because I'll always put it in my group chats and be like, has anyone heard a bit about this? Has anyone heard a bit about this? And they'll go, no, we haven't. And thankfully, from what I know so far, it's it does come with a bit of anxiety. But when comics don't watch other comics, I'm like, how can you possibly ever expect to be the best if you don't know what the best looks like?
Yeah.
That's insanity.
We'll be right back.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
And we're back with Daniel Sloss. In an interview, you said how writing this joke, you know, was a game changer for you. And it was the first time you were like, that's me. I remember that phrasing of saying that that's me. And it reminded me of, you know, two stories you tell around your sister's death. In Dark, you talk about how your mom knew you were going to be a comedian because after your sister died, you straight away were sort of making jokes to lighten the mood. And your dad remembered it was when you were going to be a comedian because even though your sister was dead, you still wanted to be the center of attention.
Yeah.
And the other story is the first time you remember making your parents laugh was the day your sister was going to be buried and you're a hearse showed up and you called it a limo.
Yeah, I thought it was a limo because it looks like a fucking limo.
And so when you say that's me, you've been doing stand-up for a while, but then this joke happens and that's me and you have these experiences. Who is the you that you saw in this joke? You know, what did you see?
It was an opinion.
Yeah,
it was my opinion. Like as you've clearly learned from this conversation, I'm unapologetic in my opinions, and obviously, I think all of my opinions are correct. Before, I was always every joke I told always had that inflection in it. It was always, "Is this funny?
Mm-hmm.
Is this funny?" And that's not how I talk in real life. That's not how I make people laugh in real life. I go, "This is fucking funny. I'm going to tell you this thing." That was the first time when. There was no question in my voice, and I felt like a stand up. For me it was a real routine, and it was the first time I'd ever had rolling laughter, like truly, like where laughter carried on between jokes. So the silences were filled by choir smatterings of laughter, you know. Which when I'm in an audience and I'm watching comedy, like I love the first big laugh. But I love being tickled for so long afterwards as well. When you've still got that, you're not laughing anymore, but you've got that smile and the occasional just the ha comes out. This joke, there's more personal jokes where every year I become more me, and it's very exciting. But that was the first time where I think if you'd ask my friends or friends of my parents, they go, that's Sloss. That's Danny. That's DJ. That's the guy we know. Because before then, I was not necessarily an overly different person on stage, but was just being a cheeky chappy or doing these sort of jokes. Yeah. And there he is. That's our mate.
It's interesting because the way you say you do more personal things, it's almost like this joke said you can be you.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. And still get laughs. I was trying to be anything else but me. Mm-hmm. And then this was the first time that they were laughing at something personal to me. Like, and they were agreeing with me. That's one of my most, you know, having horrible thoughts in your head and then saying them in front of an audience is thrilling because there's the 30% who go, no, we wouldn't. And then there's the 70 who've also had this thought or something close mm-hmm. to it. And hearing it out and loud, they go, yes. And that's what comedy's always been for me, is somebody went on and told me an opinion I didn't know I had. Yeah. They went on and they just, when I went, fucking yes, but you put it so succinctly. You took a bunch of thoughts from my brain and you smashed it together in a sentence and you made it fucking funny.
So, yeah, I was thinking about this joke for a while before I knew we were going to talk about it and I was thinking about this joke. And it wasn't until, I think this morning, that I was like, this joke is making fun of this person who just survived cancer. And I was like, the person you chose to is a person who went through a very long battle with cancer. And, you know, in the States, I don't know if it's a universal term, but people throw around the idea of punching up and punching mm-hmm. down a lot. And I think it's a bit of an inexact term. So
That's not my opinion. That's your opinion. That cancer bit, me making fun of the cancer bit, that's not what I'm doing. That's what you're doing. That's what you're saying. I'm being you. And yes, it is fucking horrific.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. This isn't my opinion. This is your opinion in its raw form of what it is. This is what you think. And I'm showing it to you. And I bet you fucking hate it because I fucking hate it.
So I want to talk broadly about how you think about the subjects or targets, in so much as you've told the story of, it's interesting, it's one joke you used to tell, which ultimately gets at both of us, which is in America, you say obesity is a disease, mm-hmm. but being gay is a choice.
Yeah.
And you stopped doing that joke because someone who was overweight reached out and said this was offensive. Or not offensive, this hurt my feelings, not offensive. But also a person around, I believe, the same time was like, thank you for telling these jokes. It inspired me to come out to my parents. Can you talk about how you think about it and how maybe that's evolved?
I don't want to upset people. I don't. It's not my job to upset people. I didn't get into this job. I want to make people laugh. And sometimes when you're trying to make someone laugh, you don't. And sometimes you hurt them. And it's not black and white. Like, sometimes you get it wrong, right? And I think we should be allowed to get it wrong. Like, that's what this part of this job is. But I'll work out whether I give a fuck if I offended someone. Yeah. And sometimes I do. Sometimes if somebody goes, hey, I know you said this and I know it was just a joke, but it felt like you were saying this. And I'll go, oh, well, that's not what I was saying. I didn't want to. And I'll take that on board. That's not censorship.
Yeah.
That's nothing like that. That's being a human being capable of empathy and learning and going, okay, you know, if somebody came up and with the punching down thing and they were like, it felt like you were attacking me in this or my people in this, I would go, well, one, was I? And if I wasn't, okay. Is it worth changing the lines? Is it important to change the lines in this? Because I don't want it to come across as insulting a type of person that I'm not insulting. Or is this person just being fucking overly sensitive?
Yeah.
And it's different each and every time, but I am open to it all of the time.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine if lots of cancer patients were like, this broke my heart, you'd be like, this is not worth it. That's a failure of the joke.
Yeah, man. If they came up and they were like, hey, that really upset me. But what I found in all these jokes, and this is what happens all the time, is it's never those people that are offended. Yeah. It's my friend's mum's dog's babysitter had cancer and it upset me. And I go, you're too far removed for me to give a shit. Don't give a fucking shit. You jumped in front of a bullet that wasn't aimed for you. That's not your fucking right. Doesn't make you a hero. Stop pretending to be one.
So let's talk about that person's offense. And you know, you've talked about offensiveness as a narcissistic act. All these people are laughing. How dare you to be like, I'm offended. Mm-hmm. But I want to put this to you. You know, I've talked to Anthony Jeselnik about this, and he goes, comedy without political correctness is like football without the football. And though he's probably talking about American football, I think the metaphor works with all types of football. Which is, if there are no lines, you are not pushing anything.
I choose what lines I want to cross, and then I choose if they're worth sort of crossing again. Like, it's just about whether I give a shit that you're upset. I like going over the lines in different ways, but I don't go over it for the sake of, or at least I don't think I do. I don't go over the line for the sake of going, no, that's definitely not true. I absolutely do. But I think when I go over the line for the sake of going across the line, I really try to make it obvious, being like, hey, this isn't my opinion, mm-hmm. but I'm going to say it, because having this opinion would be fucking awful. If you sincerely thought this, you would be the worst person in the world. But I clearly don't mean this. That's why this is funny, because I'm pretending to have this horrible opinion and taking it to its furthest extremes. And when people are offended by that, and I go, you genuinely didn't get the joke, right? They go, but you said this. And I go, yes, but I meant this. I'm not explaining sarcasm to you. I'm not explaining that joke to you.
Yeah, and you're deciding how many people not getting it is worth.
Yes, and it changes all the time, and I have been wrong before, and I will be wrong again.
I saw you perform recently, and you were talking about the idea of how rats laugh. Mm-hmm. Is it okay to bring this? I don't want to ruin it to your article.
No.
Can you talk a little bit about the idea of learning about rats laugh?
Yes, there was a great comedian called Shane Moss who had a podcast where he was basically talking about laughter, and it was one of the things that really stuck out to me, that there was scientists had done experiments where it's basically if you tickle a rat's belly, it will sort of let out joyous little squeaks, which is a rat's version of laughter. And obviously it's the sensation of being tickled, but what else is making them enjoy that? And it's because any other time the rat's having its belly openly exposed like that with something at it is a death sentence. Yeah. It's being attacked, it's about to be killed. But this is a safe version of that, and that's why it's fun. It's like, if this was happening for real, this would be fucking horrendous. But it's not happening for real, so this is dangerous. And it's dangerous, but it's safe. Like, it's, you know, it's thrilling. It's like, the reason roller coasters are exciting, because you go, I shouldn't be going this fast. This is fucking insane. And that's what comedy is a lot of times. You go, I shouldn't be saying this, but I am.
Yeah.
I'm not doing the things I'm saying. I'm pretending to do the things I'm saying. It's, you know, it's a safe violation.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get it wrong. Sometimes I explain afterwards, like, when people take offense to things, they'll go, right, allow me to explain to you why you're not allowed to be offended by that. And it's because of these reasons. And I think that's a good way of doing it. Just going, hey, let's take us, we were just in the joke, and it upset some of us. So let's step outside of the joke and let's all look what made these idiots upset, but while still being, you know, gentle and understanding, but making them understand. They go, hey, I'm not denying the fact that it upset you, but you need to understand that my intent was not to do that. I did. I'm not fucking apologizing for it, right? I'm not. If you want an apology from a comedian, go find a lesser one.
Mm-hmm.
But let's together make you understand it. And because I've done that so much in the past now, I have an audience that knows, and that's such a privilege.
It's, you know, watching you watch Dark, Jigsaw, and X in order, and it's somewhat like watching the sort of arc of a superhero, in so much as, like, Dark, it's like he's found out his powers. And Jigsaw, where you've caused all these breakups, what's number at now? 1,000?
I think the divorces is about 100. Oh, I got told about another one last night. 158.
So it causes 100. So you're like, oh, my jokes have impact. And then X is, I'm now using this power to persuade to do something.
Well, not even, X wasn't really about persuading, but the thing about X for me was, I don't think men are fucking bad people inherently.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the time we're ignorant. But here's the other thing, yelling at men doesn't work. It would be lovely. It would be so good if yelling at men worked, but it doesn't, because I know when you yell at me, I shut the fuck down and I stop listening. After everything happened, I understood the stuff I'd been ignorant about, being amongst, sexual assault and feeling complicit in things and, you know, the guilt that comes with fucking, you know, was I responsible for this? If I was responsible for this, how much was I responsible for this? How much of the onus is on me to be better? And just going, oh, fuck, I didn't know. Like, it's everything afterwards, like, oh, it's so obvious now what was happening. But that's the thing about ignorance, is it's you don't know. So it would be very easy with X to have gone and written a show. And early iterations of it was, you know, halfway through, I get a standing ovation from the women in the room. And I'm like, and I had to rewrite that bit because it was really difficult because I was, obviously, it's there to empower survivors. But when they were whooping and cheering points, I'm like, no, stop it. The men are listening. Stop. For the love of God, don't alienate them. Do not blame them for things. Do not yell at them. Explain things gently to them in the same way that I've had things carefully and delicately explained to me over the years. And there were so many times, especially in America, where you have this fucking cancerous whooping culture in comedy where... and people are like, whoa. And I'm like, don't, like, you're destroying the message. Yeah. This isn't about blaming men for things. This isn't about blaming anyone for anything. This is just, you know, I don't need to convince the women in the audience of anything.
Yeah.
Right? I don't need to. I'm not there to change their minds or even do anything. For the guys, I'm there to just go, lads, this happened to me. I didn't do enough. So just be a bit more vigilant. And it, you know, starts a dialogue.
I want to ask about how goal, like if you're goal oriented or what motivates you. I think I was hearing you talk the other day about how you decided whether or not to put a trigger warning before X. And I think that sort of gets at it. Can you explain the thinking?
Yeah. Like before when we were touring X on the roads, I had, you know, when talking about sex assault, whether I like it or not, my audience is about 55% female. So of that, about 20 to 30%, and again, these are numbers I'm pretty much pulling out my ass, but they're roughly that. 30% of them will have experienced some form of sexual assault in their life. And that's not even including the men in the room who have experienced some form of sexual assault in their life. I am, whether I like it or not, bringing up sexual assault, I'm bringing up something that affects almost a quarter of the room in some way or another, minimum. And you don't get to decide how people react to that. You don't get to tell them they're being oversensitive when they've gone through something like that. And I wanted to make sure that I was listening. It's very possible that as a straight white man who has not been sexually assaulted, that while talking about sexual assault, I'd get things wrong.
Yeah.
That's very likely. So when I was talking to survivors after this show, and because I did, that's why I always did meet and greets after the show, because I wanted to talk, I wanted to be corrected on things.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the very few times where I go, I do care. I do care if this upsets me. The last people I want to upset in that room is survivors. This joke is for them. So there were many times when, you know, it was a really difficult show to do. I had to have blinders on the stage so I couldn't see the audience because I the second you start talking about it, I can read body language.
Yeah.
You know who it's happened to. And people get upset because you're bringing up the worst moment in their life and they're allowed to react in that sad way. But it put me off or fucked up my timing because, you know, I don't want to upset people.
Yeah.
And then we would occasionally have walkouts. They were never angry walkouts. They were never rageful. Oh, you can't. It was fucking, buddy, this is too much.
Yeah.
This is too much. And I had many discussions where it came up with survivors. They were like, I just think you should put a trigger warning on the show. And I would say, if I put a trigger warning on the show, it's going to deter the type of men who should see the show from seeing the show. Because, fuck it, man, I'll be honest, if you put a trigger warning on the show, I'm going to be like, oh, what the fuck is this shit? Was this oversensitive? You know, I would have that reaction, and I didn't want it to do that. Also, I think it would take away the impact. So, trigger warning, this contains a story about sexual assault. Part of the fucking impact is them not knowing what it's about. So I had this conversation once, and then I had this conversation twice, and then I had this conversation three times. And every time the survivor was like, I get your point. I'm like, hey, this is grey. There is no right or wrong to this. Like, I am really sorry, but, and I do take on board what you're saying, but I do think I'm right in not putting the trigger warning on. And then we were in San Francisco and three women walked out in a row. And I was like, that's the end of my argument. Yeah. It's all over, right? It's one too many. Well, it's fucking six too many altogether. But now it's it has to be changed. And fortunately, on the tour, we didn't have to do it via a big, we didn't have to put it on the posters
yeah.
because my support act, Kai, was able to just do it
yeah.
before. He was like, just at the end of his day, he was like, just to let you know, Sloss does what it always does, which is tackles hard topics. He's going to be talking about pedophiles. He's going to be talking about sexual assaults with that. So it was an easier way yeah. to get it in. But I'm very glad those conversations happened.
You know, we were talking throughout this entire interview, your ability to sort of talk about tough subjects, your ability to do dark material broadly defined. Do you feel the need to talk about dark stuff? Do you think about, I've heard you say that doing X took a toll on you doing that so many times. I saw you the other night and I was like, his material right now is very silly. Like, do you think about like, what is your material without that? Is that something that interests you?
I want to get back to straight stand-up, man. Like, it's what I love most in the world. It just so happens that, you know, I did three shows that had heavy subject matter, but they were not intentional. The shows became those shows to start. That's why the next tour is called Hubris.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm known for this one thing. I don't want to corner myself into the thing. I don't want to be known as the guy that does that. I don't owe my audience that. I don't owe my audience anything other than what I find funny.
Yeah.
But what I'm not going to do is walk around going, what can I say? What can I say? What's Daniel Sloss's deep and profound opinion on this today? That's forced.
Yeah.
None of the other shows were ever forced. They happened and were created naturally, and that's why the way they were. And this next show is just... Like I want to be one of the best at stand up. Just one of the bits where I want people to watch me in the same way I watch Bill Burr, just go and fucking teach me, King. Just let me learn from and.
So you in an interview you did a while ago, it was a small aside, but you talked about how Edinburgh has a prize for the best comedy show, but not the funniest comedy show.
Yeah.
And as you said, you're pretty vocal about your desire to be the best comedian in the mm-hmm. world. So what does that mean to you?
People that make you think, like when you still think about the routines days later. I remember the first time I saw, I always watch stuff at the Edinburgh Festival every single year with my dad. And I remember the first time I saw Jim Jefferies live, like he was making points. He was talking about subjects. And after the show, me and my dad would be talking about the subjects, and then months later, when that topic came up, I would be like, "Oh, have you heard Jim Jefferies routine mm-hmm. about this?" Like jokes that exist outside of the special. That's the best when it sticks out beyond. You know, yes, it's hysterical. Like, yes, it's funny, but there is just something more. It resonated with a different part of my brain other than just the rat tickling bit. It gave me something more. Or it changed my mind.
Yeah.
Or it made me more open to an idea. Like, I've definitely had... I've had opinions changed by stand-up comedians, by routines. I've watched it and gone, fuck, I'd never considered it that way. That's real power. That's the best. Just so much more than just the laughter. That being said, the laughter is the most important part of it.
That sound means it's time for our final segment, which is the laughing round. It's like a lightning round, but because it's comedy, it's a laughing round. Do you have a favorite joke?
One always pops to my mind, and it's not there's a bit of political incorrectness in this, but not in a bad way. What noise does a gay shark make?
What?
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Just always tickled me.
Is there a joke you wish you could steal? In so much as it is now out of whosoever act it was in. It is now in your act. Everything else in the world is the same. No one's going to yell at you for stealing. It's always been yours.
I'd say, well, if I could, we think we know you, Bo Burnham's routine.
Yeah.
Fucking, that was one of the times when you want to talk about the best. That was, as a comedian, I watched that routine and I went, oh, Bo wrote that for me. Oh, that was real nice of Bo to write specifically a routine just for me. What a nice, swell thing of that lovely man to do. I'd love that one. Yeah.
So you've performed all over the world, and I was thinking I'd like you to pick the three best and three worst cities to perform in, but just list all of them so it doesn't look like you're throwing any city out on the bus.
Oh, Kilmarnock worst. I'll tell Kilmarnock in Scotland. I will never gig there ever fucking again. Fuck everyone from that city.
All right, never mind. What are the three worst and what are the three best?
Adelaide, and I say Adelaide, they know they get a shit time. I'll see you April and I'll say it to your fucking faces, you pieces of shit. You suck. Your city sucks. They're awful. God, who else? Indiana. That's not true. I went to Indianapolis last year and they were actually fucking great. And then best audience is New York, mm-hmm. genuinely. Sydney and Glasgow.
You mentioned this at the show. What are the three best cursing countries in the world?
Oh, Scotland, obviously. Australia is exceptional at swearing. They love it. And Irish. The Irish are very good at swearing.
And America's the worst.
America's, you're so appalling at it, man. I say it in the podcast. It's twat. It's pronounced twat. For the love of fucking God, on behalf of the rest of the world, stop pronouncing it twat, you fucking imbeciles. It's twat. It rhymes with cat. It rhymes with hat. Twat.
Last one. Can you do an impression of yourself?
Oh, look at me. I hate God. Oh, I'm so fucking woke. Blah, blah, blah.
Great. That's it. We did it.
Hey, thank you so much.
That's it for another episode. You can stream Dark and Jigsaw on Netflix and X on HBO Now and HBO Go. Follow Daniel on Twitter @Daniel_Sloss and on Instagram @DanielSloss. Good One is produced by myself, Jelani Carter, and Art Chung. Gautam Srikishan did our theme song. Editorial assistance from Amanda Gordon and Emily Sin. Write a review and rate the show on Apple Podcasts. 5 stars, please. You can email any comments, questions, or laughing around suggestions to goodonepodcast@gmail.com or tweet at us @goodonepodcast. I'm Jesse David Fox, and you can follow me @JesseDavidFox. Good One is a production of Vulture and the Vox Media Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with Sarah Schaefer. Have a good one.